and welcome to the show. It's Evan Bray. Great to have you here on a Thursday morning. Some clouds. I mean, we've seen some showers sweep through the province, and it will clear up as the day wears on. In fact, as we head towards the weekend, pretty nice weather. Hot, straight shot of sunshine, upwards of close to 30 degrees in parts of the province for the weekend. So all in all, temperature-wise, it's definitely going to be a nice one. Well, yesterday we started a conversation that to me is too important I didn't want to stop it yesterday. I wanted to continue it today, and I'm happy that we're able to. So just to remind you, we had Minister Dan Williams on the show yesterday. He's the Alberta Minister of Mental Health and Addictions. And what we talked about there is the Compassionate Intervention Act that they are looking to bring in. It hasn't been passed yet, but basically they put together a process, and this is part of what they call the Alberta Recovery Model, to try and help people with addictions. It actually works really similar to, we have a youth detox process in Saskatchewan where family members of youth can make an application ultimately to get approved by a judge, by a third party, to allow that youth to be apprehended and taken to a center, a facility, where they are given some sort of treatment and an attempt to bring stability to them. Does it work every time? No. Does it work most times? Probably not. I don't have the stats on it, but it does give loved ones a way to step in and do something in the way of intervention. This Alberta model, which is for adults, is very similar. It's got the ability of a loved one, of a family member, of people that are given authorization by the Act to make an application for an assessment to be done, a hearing by an expert. They've got a panel of people, including a member of the public, someone who represents Indigenous peoples, on this committee to make a determination whether or not this person will be brought into a 3 or 6 month treatment plan with a wider set of healthcare options. We opened up the phone lines yesterday to discuss, is this the way we should be going in Saskatchewan? Now, there's a list of reasons why these are good ideas, and there's a list of reasons why these are bad ideas. And some of it is that the data isn't there that completely supports that this works. The effectiveness of this strategy is being brought into question. I think the counter, or the thing that I like to ask the question is are we achieving success now by doing what we're doing? And if not, my sincere hope is let's find something that works. And this is where I'm happy to bring in my next guest. My next guest is Sarah Kosciusko. We've had Sarah on the program before, and I had the pleasure of working alongside Sarah and her team back in my day with the Bridgeana Police Service. Sarah's a pharmacist and the operator of Queen City Wellness Pharmacy in the city of Regina. Sarah and her team work on the front lines of this addiction crisis in our province every single day. Sarah, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I know you and I have talked about this over a coffee sitting in your back boardroom before, this notion of forced medical treatment or secure treatment facilities. Are you aware of what Alberta is looking to go towards? And can you maybe just revisit your thoughts on this topic?
So I'm only like very shallowly aware of what's going on in Alberta with this, but I have concerns, and my concerns are, first, we've got to look at the reason people are using substances. A lot of people are using substances. I use the analogy of like a warm blanket to kind of keep themselves warm, and we have no business taking away their blankets if we haven't taught them how to turn on the heat of their house. So if we haven't given them the skills to deal with their life, if they're using the substances to kind of block out and numb from their life, and we haven't given them any skills to deal with their life, then we've got no business taking away those substances until we have given them those skills. So treatment is a way of giving them those skills, and I applaud that. My issue is what then? Where are people going after treatment? Are they going back to the exact same situation that they were dealing with that got them into substance dependency in the first place? Because in my experience, that's exactly what we're seeing. We don't have nearly enough post-treatment houses. People are even leaving corrections to total homelessness. and it just, it gets them right back in there. People are leaving treatment partway through treatment because they're kicked out for, you know, what I sometimes would view as a smaller infraction, and going to homelessness and then ending up in jail. I've got examples of that. So what are we doing with people afterwards? What are we doing to make sure that they're not going back to the same trauma that they got in there in the first place? And until we do that, we're basically just incarcerating people. And right now we're incarcerating people with not a lot of success because we're not setting people up for success.
Mm-hmm. We, Sarah Kosciusko is my guest, pharmacist, operator of Queen City Wellness Pharmacy. You are bang on in your assessment that it is really, really tough, no matter how well the treatment goes for someone. And we're talking about it from an addiction standpoint. But as you were talking, Sarah, I'm thinking about people that are trying to get out of the gang life. For many of them, they can be part of a process to try and make that happen. But if their return to normal is the situation that it looked like before, it becomes very tough. The odds are stacked against them and their likelihood of success. So how do we guard against that? Do we have options? And I'm not expecting you to have the solutions, but you work in this every day. What are some things that you think we need to be doing or doing more of that might work?
So there's a few things. One, whenever we have contact with somebody, we need to be wrapping around them with services. So, you know, right now we have some great things that have come into place. That complex detox situation can be really good. Every single person I've met that has gone there for the day has had a really good environment there. But then what? Nothing. So why aren't we wrapping around them, making sure that they're on social services, make sure that they've, you know, gotten a SPADAT done, gotten their housing done, you know, made inquiries about the safety of where they're at and done some intensive support from that spot. We're not doing it anywhere that we already have contact with people. We don't do it in the hospital. People are leaving the hospital to homelessness. And like I said, we had somebody got out of the pen last week, and they were basically just let out onto the street. I don't know what we expect that person to do other than commit crimes or use substances and get back in jail. So
where's the line, Sarah? Because I know exactly what you're saying. And we've had this discussion before. In fact, we had it, and I don't want to take us too far off topic, but a person who was a serious offender was being released in the community. And people were saying, well, this is a safety issue because this person is a dangerous offender. But when the sentence is done and there's no further ways through the courts to compel them to comply. What do you see as an option for people that are getting out of jail and maybe have become clean because of the fact they were in jail, but now are going back into their situation?
So these are two different situations. The dangerous offenders that you're talking about are people that are like choosing to be a dangerous offender. Sometimes not, but sometimes. A lot of them we're talking about like sex offenders. The people I'm talking about are people who are more victims of their circumstances, using substances and committing crimes to use their substances. And so the people that you're discussing had somewhere to go, but through compulsion and through maybe medical conditions or through whatever the reason is that they're recommitting crimes and getting back in jail, that is different than the people that are leaving to homelessness and having to find a trap house or a spot on the street to sleep because there's literally nowhere to go. You know, you go and go through all the proper channels right now in Regina to get housing, and it might be 8 or 9 months, which is something that was shocking to me as somebody who hadn't experienced this growing up. So you go down to social services, and you need ID, and you need all of these things to get even that part of it started, and then you go and get a SPADAT done, and that is kind of a very invasive and intensive questionnaire where they kind of figure out where you belong, and then that gets sent to a housing coordinator who will decide whether or not they take you, and you might be on that list for 8 or 9 months before you have anybody even helping you find housing. Mm. So that should already be set up when people are leaving corrections or leaving recovery facilities, that they have a home to go to, and they've got appropriate home to go to, meaning they've got supports around them, people that will make sure that they're getting to their doctor's appointments, make sure they've got food in their fridge, and helping them be successful. And we know through a lot of studies that that is way cheaper for people than incarcerating people or putting them in rehab or putting them in anywhere else. Having at least supporting them through a healthy life is cheaper than any of these other options, yet we just drop people off basically on the street and walk away.
Sarah Kosciuszko is my guest, pharmacist, operator of Queen City Wellness Pharmacy in Regina. I've talked often on the show about my support for harm reduction. I see harm reduction has to be, it's instrumental in the, whatever you want to call it, the three-legged stool to trying to find a way to work through this addiction crisis. But harm reduction only works, in my view, is if it's a means to an end. If it's a way to keep people alive and keep people healthy or as healthy as possible until you can get them into a bed for recovery, that to me is where, for those really complex cases, I wonder if some sort of secure treatment facility isn't an option. If the aftercare was there, do you see then those treatment facilities as an option, again, for those extreme cases, Sarah?
You know, it's a complicated question. I hate to give an absolutely and absolutely not. I've got examples where for sure that has worked. And I right now am wishing that I had an option like that for certain people or mental health facilities or things like that. People that are coming in every day that are a risk to themselves and a risk to others, that have unmet medical needs, like mental health needs, and that they're using crystal meth to substitute the fact that their bipolar disorder is uncontrolled. And I wish that we had something to do, because I've called the police and I've called ambulances to try to get this person help so many times, and they're back, you know, to square one the next day, walking down 12th Avenue butt naked. You know, like, it's, there's huge risk. So I think that there is a place for some of it. I think that we need to get people to a place where they can make decisions about their lives. And right now, most of the people living on the street with substance dependency are not making any decisions about their own lives, period. They're answering to their addiction. They're answering to their dealer. They're answering to everybody but their own, like, wants and dreams. But I think that there's a lot of ways to get people there without forced treatment. Is forced treatment possibly necessary for some cases? Probably. But I also see a lot of success with the homes that the Friendship Center here in Regina is running. They've got 2 10-men homes that are going, and their harm reduction model, and giving people, you know, daily security while they're using substances has gotten most of them totally, like, having control over their day-to-day activities, using a lot less, if at all, having no interactions with police. Their medical needs are taken care of. And the cost response to that is so clear that we're saving money for the government. Phoenix Residential had a very similar study happen, you know, when they had the highest risk people in the city, the people that were using cells and that were using detox beds and the hospital, they house these people, and all of a sudden all those crimes went away. So I don't know if we need to be forcing people into treatment when we have models that are very, very successful through Phoenix House and through what the Friendship Center are doing that work and still give people some autonomy over their lives.
It's a complicated one for sure. And those, you're giving examples of organizations that I've had the good fortune to work with through the years. And I couldn't agree with you more. They do incredible work. The sad reality is there's always people that'll slip through the cracks. It works for this group, doesn't work for this group. And so.
You're absolutely right. We've had people that, you know, aren't successful there. And for those people, like, I work very closely with all of these groups, so I know the people that are slipping through those cracks, and those people, you know, have other generally unmet mental health needs.
Right.
It's not, again, that they're criminals. So we need better mental health care. It just seems to be that there's always, we're looking for a reason to like lock people up and put them away instead of actually dealing with the situation, which, again, is not good for them. And it's not good for us as society, as taxpayers and as human beings.
And to be clear, I want, and I think, you know, I mean, I'm not advocating that we lock them up from a justice standpoint. I am saying these are health issues. They need to be dealt with through a health lens. But in some cases, and well, you know where I'm going. I do feel in some extreme cases, this is a way to keep them safe from their harming themselves and safe from being victimized in the community. Because you know this as well as I do, Sarah. Many of these people are highly victimized. They're vulnerable, or they're putting themselves in situations because they're finding a way to fuel that addiction that they've got.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Like, I think that there's a place for this. But I just worry that it'll be used too broadly instead of using these other means, which, you know, would be better for everybody to have another way of doing this than long-term locking people up.
Sarah, I knew it would be a good conversation. Thanks for what you do and your team does every day. You at the Queen City Wellness Pharmacy, you do great work, and I appreciate you giving me some time this morning.
Right back at you anytime. I enjoy these conversations. Thank you for having me.
Here, that's Sarah Kazusko, a pharmacist, again, Queen City Wellness Pharmacy in Regina, one of many. We have community-based organizations in Regina, Saskatoon, and throughout the province that are dealing every day frontline with this addiction crisis. We also have emergency responders who are dealing with it, and we're all trying to find the solution. I just know that we're a ways away from getting there yet. Like to open up the phone lines. More of your thoughts when we come back here on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. Topic of the drug crisis that is happening in the province. We had a couple of conversations in the last day or so. Yesterday, we had on Minister Dan Williams, the Alberta Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, about the Compassionate Intervention Act that they're looking at standing up in Alberta. I said, should we be looking at something like that? Secure treatment facility in Saskatchewan. Callers that we had yesterday, lots of them with lived experience or family members with lived experience, said they thought that would be a good move for certain cases. My last guest, Sarah Kazusko, says, you know, we got to be careful with that, because if after this heavy investment of 6 months, for example, of treatment and therapy, they're going back into the same situation, is the likelihood of relapse high? A valid question to ask. What are your thoughts? What is the vision? What is the correct way, route to go to deal with this drug crisis? Secure treatment have its place? 1-877-332-8255. We'll open up the phone lines just after 11 for your thoughts here on 980 CJME and 650 CKOM. Good morning, and thank you for joining us, Evan Bray, on this Thursday morning. And we've been into a fairly big conversation here when we talk about the drug crisis. And the drug crisis is real in this province. I think most people know of it and have either seen it, experienced it with through a family member, an acquaintance, someone they know. Many people yesterday joined the conversation with lived experience about what their journey was like and what worked for them. So we started the conversation yesterday as we took a bit of a closer look at the Compassionate Intervention Act they're looking at bringing in Alberta. We had Minister Dan Williams on the show. He's Alberta's Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, talking about the Alberta recovery model, their focus on making recovery not only possible but probable. And you know, let's say it up front, intervention doesn't need to be criminal. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. This isn't about using the criminal justice system, but this is using a system whereby courts and an assessment process and a hearing exists. And if all of the tests are met, a person can be compelled into treatment, forced treatment, involuntary treatment, however you want to look at it, with an expectation, number one, it's not short. It likely will last 3 or 6 months. And number two, it provides a wide array of healthcare options to try and stabilize the person enough that they can envision a better life for themselves. Not for everybody. It's there's very extreme cases where there's no other options that are available, and this might be the way to go. Now, there are already community programs that are active and working, and although it doesn't happen quickly, are making a difference one person at a time. And Sarah Kosciuszko was on the show this morning. She's a pharmacist. She's the operator of Queen City Wellness Pharmacy in Regina. She's on the front lines of this drug crisis every day. And she talked about some of the different community-based programs and groups that are out there doing great work, that are making a difference, that are helping people get away from their addiction and get on to a better life. In the meantime, there's a ton of people falling through the cracks, and there's no easy solution. It's safe to say we all want to find a solution. We don't know what the perfect solution is, and it's sometimes tough to agree on that. Okay, Kevin has been waiting patiently from Saskatoon. Kevin, I appreciate you calling in. We're just talking about what the right direction to go is with regard to addiction crisis in our province. Have you got some thoughts on this?
Well, thanks for taking my call, Evan. As a former professional in the field for about 18 years, I worked in corrections. I had many opportunities. I administered on and off over those 18 years addictions education programs, worked in the welding and carpentry shop, facilitating programs that existed 20, 30 years ago that do not exist now. And where I go with this, and Sarah hit the nail on the head with a lot of her points. I was so impressed with her her delivery this morning. We are lacking critical programming that has been eroded over the years in both federal and provincial correctional centers, and that is manpower programs that facilitate with private companies in the community. And I'll give you an example of this, Evan. Prince Albert Correctional Center years ago used to have a very intensive gardening program that supplied potatoes and vegetables for every correctional center in the province of Saskatchewan. That's been eroded now and privatized to different companies that are providing this now, and they've taken those programs away. And what I saw as a worker evolving over the years that I practiced in there, and many of the things that Sarah said that backs this up, these individuals come into a correctional center addicted. They are forced, once they're incarcerated, to sober up. They have no choice.
Right.
And you know, there's some illicit drugs that can get in on and off because that addiction is so strong. However, once they get sobered up, and there's a time period that they wait through, and then they could apply for these programs. They've since removed the welding program, carpentry program, and many of these programs where all they're doing now is providing, and again, not 100%, but providing only mental health programming as opposed to giving them some physical activity and a reward, because these guys got paid, although it was nominal, there was a reward system. And once they were able to get to a certain point in their career in the correctional center, a lot of private companies would call us as managers of these welding and carpentry shops and ask, hey, who do you have getting released in the next 2 or 3 months?
Interesting.
That would be a good welder, a good fit for our program. And we would most often give references to a lot of these individuals that could gain positive employment as soon as they left the correctional facility.
Yeah.
That is key.
So,
and there's a, there's an old saying, idle minds, idle time creates crime.
Right.
And that is where I go with this. And I think Sarah has a good grasp on all of this based, and that's from a pharmaceutical end.
Right.
And you can't be reliant on these pharmaceuticals. And I think what's really important here is we've seen the devolution, if you like, of our federal government. And I, there's no mixing words on this, of providing these addictive things like legalizing marijuana, gateway drugs, what we saw in British Columbia. These things need to be regulated to the point that they don't need to exist anymore. And I'm sorry for all the recreational users. Every gateway drug, whether it be alcohol, marijuana, vaping for that matter, these are all drugs. They're all addictive, and they are gateway drugs. And that's what we were used to be taught in addictions education, but now somehow using the word gateway drugs is not appropriate anymore.
Well, Kevin, your expertise, shines through for sure. The interesting take on the loss of these programs and what that looks like. I do wonder, too, Sarah talked about people that find themselves after, whether it's incarceration, she pointed out, or going through some sort of a longer treatment program. If they return to the same environment they were in before, that many would argue was a complicating factor in their addiction process, are we setting them up to fail if we put them back? But, you know, Kevin's point about businesses proactively reaching out saying, have you got someone, we're looking for a welder, we're looking for someone that's acquired these skills, I think paints a great picture and gives a good argument as to why that sort of training, skills-based training, needs to continue to be supported, prioritized, and funded in correctional centers. So thanks for the call. There was a text on the line. Now, this is a super long text, and I'm not going to be able to read it all. It is it's a bit of an essay, if I'm being honest. But the theory in here, and I don't have even a name attached to it, but the theory is safe supply needs to be part of the solution. The text reads, safe supply, this is the solution. However, counterintuitive it may seem, especially in our very, very conservative province, but it is the answer. And the texter talks about what other countries have done and what they've tried, but talks about people who go on to safe supply, get their lives back instead of doing crime, stealing, trying to get money, and then going to get their drugs. Rinse, repeat every single day. Instead, with safe supply, they get their daily safe supply. Once they realize they have all this time on their hands, they don't have to resort to crime anymore, devote time to fixing other issues, basically finding hope in their lives. Safe supply is it's a side of this that people advocate for. And again, the texter says someone who's experienced both sides of this discussion. Lots of people not for safe supply, and I know BC went that route and then has since pulled back from it. So there's some controversy about that, but there's some advocates out there, and this texter is a good example of it. Isaac from Weyburn says, for recovery to be successful, you need to change your people, places, and things. If they can't help a person do that, then the attempt is pretty much useless. Bryn from Saskatoon, I really think this comes down to, what would you want for yourself or your loved ones? Mandated help or a continued downward spiral that could end in death? It's hard to believe this is even a debate. I'm not sure how the extreme left has gotten such a chokehold on our society. You know, the arguments against mandatory treatment or secure treatment facilities are things like it's a violation of the autonomy of the person. It overrides their personal freedoms when people are competent but not compliant. I would argue the people that I feel need to go into a secure treatment facility are not competent. They are the people that we are seeing making bad decisions, if it's for their safety, if it's for the safety of others, or if it's just for the overall wellness of the community. This is part of it. I know institutions can be traumatizing to people, and so there's a recognition of that. But at the same time, if what is happening right now, it is, as that last texter said, rinse and repeat. We're just seeing the same thing over and over again. Are we headed in the right direction? This is a great debate. The number of people that called in yesterday and today, texts and calls with experience one way or another on this, is quite impressive. And for that, I'm very appreciative. Okay, let's take another break. When we come back, we actually didn't dive too deep into this whole Saskatchewan's worst roads thing this morning. We got mired down in political talk, but I did want to give you some airtime to be able to talk about. We can review the top 10 places. Is there one missing off the list? You drive the roads every day in this province. In fact, some of you, that's your job. You're in the truck. You're on the road all the time. Where are the bad ones? Did CAA Saskatchewan get the list right, or is something missing? We'll talk about the worst roads in the province and your thoughts when we come back on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. Look out to the left, the captain said, the light. Good morning, and thanks so much for listening in to the Evan Bray Show. It's good to have you here. We opened the conversation this morning about a few different things on open lines, and one of the things we talked about was this list of CAA Saskatchewan's worst roads. Now, I will step aside for a second and just read this text from Peter in Weyburn, because he's right. I'm not arguing at all what Peter's saying. He said, CAA's worst roads is decided by people's votes. So if less or no people vote on a particular road, it doesn't make the list. CAA basically tallies the roads and reports the results. Pete from Weyburn, you're right. 100% right, which is why I'm opening up a phone line for a short second here, 7 minutes or so, just to hear from you, because on the worst roads list, we've got things like Highway 35 out of Weyburn, Warman Road in Saskatoon, two different locations, 13th Avenue Northwest and 5th Avenue Northwest in Moose Jaw, both of which are said to be terrible. Saskatchewan 123, Saskatchewan 102 out of LaRonge, Saskatchewan Highway 47 Springside, number 2 out of Cudworth, 339 out of Avonlea. Number one, by the way, the worst road in Saskatchewan as deemed by this survey, which, back to the point of it's people's votes. So clearly a lot of people from the Buchanan area voted for Highway 5, saying poor road maintenance, it's in rough shape. Keeping in mind, our province has 250,000 kilometers of roadways. Remember, that was our Saskatchewan's smartest radio listener question not that long ago. So we have the most roadways of any province in Canada. And so maintaining those can be a challenge. But if you had to pick one that was bad, is it already on the list or have you got something else? This Highway 378 between North Battleford and Spiritwood must be bad, because now I've had four people text on it. Four different people. TJ is on the road this morning. He sent a text in saying it is brutal, and it has been for years. 1-877-332-8255. Worst road that you've driven on. If you're out there on the road, where is it? I'd love to hear from you. Highway 22, I remember that being on the list last year, and part of the reason I remember it is Highway 22 kind of does a jog, but it does go through my hometown of Abernethy and curls around, goes by Lemberg and on to Newdorf. Didn't make the list this year. So maybe it's better. Last time I drove it out in that neck of the woods, it wasn't too bad. 1-877-332-8255. Is there a bad road out there that you drive? Jonathan and Warman, you got a bad highway that you drive regularly?
Well, this is, I drive all over the province regularly, but there's one highway that I have to go down it, I kind of shudder, just for the simple fact it's a long portion of highway in this province, and it's Highway 2. Like, granted, yeah, the province did put some work into it from where Highway 5 westbound goes towards Saskatoon between there and the Kwanzaa 16 interchange, yeah, going down towards Watrous. And to Watrous isn't that bad, but from Prince Albert all the way down to Chamberlain is probably the worst overall highway.
Is that right? Is it potholes? Is it cracks? Is it heaves? What is it?
It's wavy. It's wavy. Really bad. And actually, you know what? Now that I mentioned that, this is actually really stupid, but there is actually a really wavy portion of the Yellowhead between North Battleford and Paynton as well. And I like in a four-wheeler, you don't feel it, because I've driven that stretch many times in a private vehicle. But in a commercial truck, it is horrendous.
Well, and those in a commercial truck, like you're talking about, Jonathan, I mean, yeah, it can be bad. I mentioned Highway 22. I just got a text, Evan, Highway 22 is brutal. Okay, fair enough. I mean, I didn't, like I said, it wasn't on the list. Last time I drove it, I didn't notice it to be terrible, but it splits. Highway 22 splits. It goes from the junction of Highway 10 south by Abernethy, but it also goes up through past kind of Fort Capel there and north. And so last year, I think it was that north stretch of Highway 22 that was on the list. 1-877-332-8255. Sometimes it's the roads or the streets in cities that are bad. I got Ian on the phone from Saskatoon. I know there's some spots, I'm sure, in Saskatoon.
Yeah, I'd like to ask your screener if it has to be highways. He said no.
No, so it doesn't have to be highways. No.
I was coming down 33rd from Avenue P going towards Polytech at Idlewild, and traffic was really heavy. And I thought, well, Avenue C used to be a decent road, and but I know the city doesn't want traffic going down there anymore, so I hope this isn't why the road is bad. I turned off 33rd to go south on Avenue C. That first road from 33rd, I don't remember if it goes just to 32nd or 31st, I couldn't believe how broken that pavement is and how deep the holes were and how many there were. Plus, it's a narrow street with traffic parked on each side. And I can have a full-size truck. And I found it very difficult to navigate.
You got nowhere to go, right, with vehicles parked on both sides.
Yeah, and I for anybody that has a car, I can't see them not bottoming out. And it has been a long time since I've seen a paved road in Saskatoon that bad.
Yeah, it's, I just saw a text on the line that says, it's not two streets in the city of Moose Jaw, it's the entire city, one of the texters said. A couple of streets, 13th Avenue Northwest, and what was the other one? 5th Avenue Northwest in Moose Jaw are the two that made the CAA Saskatchewan Worst Road List. Okay, we've hit the end of this half hour. I do have guests coming in to join me after 11:30, but hopefully before 12, I'll try and get to a few more of your texts. Some great, compelling thoughts here. Daryl, sorry to leave you hanging on the phone from Kenora, that neck of the woods. Buchanan, one of the places that is, according to this list, famous for bad roads right now. Thanks to everyone that's joining in. I'll try and get to more of your texts before 12 o'clock today here on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME.